Crossing the event horizon, all of us will have to do that at one time. Jonathan Zapp with us, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back. We'll talk more with him about this, the other side, and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Jonathan Zapp and your calls as well. Jonathan, if you were around when Harry Houdini was around looking for the proper medium so he could contact his dead mother, what would you have advised him?
Well, I would have advised him that most mediums don't seem like the real thing. At least this has been my experience.
Yeah.
I believe that there are such people. I mean, I personally have contact all the time, but it's not like on demand. I can't do it for strangers. It's just with like mostly like with one or two people that, well, one especially that I knew in real life, and one that I've kind of been in touch with, you know, since an early age. Whenever I've heard mediums come on your show and on other shows or met them in person, they'll give a fantastically authentic sounding rap about their life and how they got into it, and I'm like, wow, this person really, you know, sounds like the real thing, until I hear them do their shtick, until there's like open lines and people are calling in, and then in every case that I've experienced, it's just sounded like the worst cold reading of all time. Like, I see an older man with a watch, you know, like, you know, just these things that would apply to anybody, and it just seems like very poor cold readings. Now, I'm sure, I know Gary Schwartz has mediums that he works with that he's authenticated and so forth, and you know, again, I've had my own individual experiences, but as far as professional mediums, I'm waiting to meet one that is the real thing. So I would just tell him, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Even though there may be an ocean of bathwater, there may still be a few babies there too.
Now, back to some of the evidence, Jonathan, that you talked about to try to convince the world that the other side exists. I guess we could use, as you mentioned, near-death experiences, the testimony of those who come back as evidence, can't we? Would that hold up in court?
Well, it depends on what the testimony is. I mean, a lot of it would be anecdotal, but then when we have, like, the Pam Reynolds case, I review that one extensively in my book. In some of the strongest cases, I mean, there's no outfit more doubting of anything supernatural than National Geographic. But they did a documentary called The Hour of Death, I think it was called, where there's a man who's you know, having bypass surgery, has cardiac arrest, his eyes are taped shut, and yet in those circumstances, he's able to describe this extremely idiosyncratic thing that the surgeon did, that he would, that no other surgeon did. It was just his personal quirk. He would, between, you know, procedures, he would put his hands under his armpits and point with his elbows because he wanted to keep his hands sterile, and the man with eyes taped shut describes this, and National Geographic admits, well, we have no way of explaining this. And so there are, this is the kind of highly veridical thing that near-death experiencers will come back and tell. Not every one of them will have veridical stuff, but even the fact that people have these complex experiences, you know, you hear these people say, well, it's just an oxygen-starved brain. Well, an oxygen-starved brain, according to neuroscience, shouldn't be able to create these complex inner experiences and be able to store them in memory, as happens in near-death experience. So there are different degrees of how veridical different near-death experiences are. But when you take some of those stronger cases where people are seeing highly specific things, that when their eyes are taped shut and that kind of thing, I think it's pretty incontrovertible evidence.
Let's go to the calls. Daniel in Wichita, Kansas, to start. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I'd like to talk to your guest for just a minute.
Sure.
I have no doubt that there is an afterlife, none whatsoever. What I wanted to discuss with you is, for the last several years, I've had suffered in my life severe losses of loved ones, including two of my three children.
Oh, geez. Sorry to hear that.
Things that I greatly loved. For the last 2 years, I have experienced dreams, very lucid and vivid dreams, I'm not suicidal. I'm a Catholic, and I don't believe I gave myself life, but I'm really questioning the validity of these are almost daily or nightly dreams.
And what could they be, Jonathan? What's happening to you?
Well, during the dream time is the most common time for people to have communication because, according to many esoteric sources, when you're dreaming, you're not completely in your body. You may be close to it, but you're more dislocated from your body. You are the dream time is transtemporal. You're detached from linear time, and that's why there are so many verified accounts of clairvoyant dreams, for example. And so you are in a place that is much closer, and a state that's much closer to where they are. Now, this doesn't mean that every entity that appears in a dream is who they say they are, and that every experience in a dream is to be taken at face value. But this is one of the most common ways for such communication to happen, especially if the dreams feel highly lucid, as you described. Now, also what I think you're describing is, and this is, the oldest story in the world. If you look at the book of Job, in the Bible or Ecclesiastes, much of religion came into being because people felt tremendous grief at the loss of loved ones, and felt that their own lives were a great source of suffering. And when people have near-death experiences, including Carl Jung, the great Swiss psychiatrist who had one in the 1940s, most people do not want to come back. Most people who do come back do so because they have a feeling of obligation and wanting to complete their life mission.
Or they're forced to come back, aren't they?
Right. Some people are pulled or yanked back, or they don't have a choice. But we'll describe the other side as more real and feeling more like home, and that being back in a meat body was, as one woman described it, felt like putting on dirty underwear. And so it is a very common experience for people to regret being incarnated in a physical body. And I think some people even have that as sort of an innate memory of just like, oh my God, how did I let this happen to myself again? And are always very ambivalent about human life. On the other hand, what you also have in all this testimony from many different cultures is that life is sort of like boot camp. It's this immense learning struggle. Everything we do here is highly consequential. Many people who are spirits envy the living because of how much spiritual progress they can make and how much difference they can make by being in a body. So it is considered a great opportunity, but an extremely difficult one. But the thing is that, if you think that there's something better on the other side, as I do for most of us.
Sure.
There's no rush because it is the one absolute guarantee. It is more of a guarantee than taxes or anything else. You have a guaranteed escape portal. No matter how bad the circumstances are, you're here for a very limited time only, but you don't want to cheat this experience because the testimony from so many different people is that if you miss the opportunity to learn here, you'll have to repeat it. And you may regret, ending your life early and that kind of thing.
Let's go to Wolf, first time caller, El Paso, Texas. Hi, Wolf. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. I got George, first off, I've been a fan since the late 90s. I've always listened to you and tried to catch you when I could.
Thank you, Wolf, for staying with us.
Jonathan, I believe it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. A long time ago, I taught my mother and my grandmother about my meditation place. I got a safe spot that I go to. It's rather short and sweet. It's a little beach with drop holes and stuff like that where I drop my problems. And I've told them that anytime they're ever out and about, they could always find me there. Well, a lot of times during my meditations when I'm there, I do believe in the afterlife because I've seen both of the two most important women in my life in my past life there, and that's my mother and my grandmother, and both of them come and advise me at that spot, but yet I can't communicate with them nowhere else. Is there a reason for that, or is it something I may have done with them, or...
Well, I can think of a few possible reasons. Now, when you say that this is your meditation spot, do you mean it is a place that you visualize, or it's an actual physical spot that you go to meditate?
It's a visualization.
Okay, well, that's what I was hoping you would say, because...
that's a big difference, isn't it?
What you are doing is you're creating a highly stable location in the imaginal world. There's an ancient technique called theater of memory that may have dated back to ancient Egypt. It was originally developed as a mnemonic practice, but where you would build this estate in your mind, a walled-in castle or house, and make it more and more stable, more detailed, and so forth. And that's a very powerful practice that serves all kinds of purposes. Well, in effect, you've created a theater of memory. You've created a highly stable location in the imaginal plane. And this, as compared to, say, the average daydream or nighttime dream, that's sort of like a cascade of like MTV-like images, a very highly unstable kaleidoscopic world. You've created this stable platform in the imaginal, and that makes it a bridge to entities on the other side. And so that is a very powerful thing to do, and it's something that I practice in different forms myself as well.
I think it's fascinating, though, that he can let his mind wander into the state to communicate with his loved ones.
Yeah, a lot of the times it's just shutting down the noise. It's just sort of like in Whitley Strieber's wonderful book that came out recently, The Afterlife Revolution, his wife Anne from the other side says, to us it looks like most of you are just ignoring us. A lot of times people, just like people don't listen to the voice of intuition in their own minds, and we have a lot of research on this, they often are so distracted and don't quiet down enough and don't just, you know, stand or sit still long enough to be able to recognize subtle telepathic communication. And so just taking time out to do that is often all that's necessary. And that's why a very common thing is that people who are not particularly spiritual people and stuff, often they will have a sudden and dramatic contact with a loved one who's departed, often, you know, a short time after they've departed, while driving.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't think it would happen while driving, but while they're driving, they're in a kind of meditative state. Their brain is driving on autopilot, and they're not hopefully texting or something like that. And that's a time when this kind of communication can break through. And some of the highly evidential cases are people having extremely vivid contact with deceased loved ones where they did not know that they were deceased.
Jeez.
These are called peak and Darien experiences. There's a whole lot of them, and they are also very strongly evidential, in my opinion, because, you know, it will be a brother, a sister who's young and healthy, but it has had a
and nobody communicated with them.
Right, yeah. Exactly, and they'll have this intense contact.
Let's go to Michelle in Columbus, North Dakota. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Hello. I would refer to a quote from Rupert Sheldrake. He said that what we perceive to be memory is actually quantum-level physical links across time. So in that sense, when we are speaking with the dead, maybe we are doing Art Bell's wish for kind of a little bit of time travel.
Well, maybe. Maybe. Well, where does time travel fit into any of this, Jonathan?
Well, it fits in many profound ways. In that book I was talking about, The Unobstructed Universe, I mean, it's called The Unobstructed Universe because they live in the unobstructed universe. We live in the obstructed universe. We live, if you remember that book from the 19th century, Flatland, you know, they have access to additional dimensions that we don't have and that limit us. And so we are kind of living in this extreme sliver of linear time where I can't do anything. I can't move a pencil on my desk a second ago or a second in the future. I'm only in this one tiny sliver of the present, and I have no access to any other place in space or time unless I physically, you know, leave my room or get in a car or something. People on the other side are in a hyperdimensional. They have an additional dimension so that they can look at time quite differently. You know, like I was told, you know, you think of your life as sort of like the story that may lead to some culminating event, like, you know, suddenly people will buy your book or something like that. But we see you more as like a time glow. We see your whole life, you know, the whole radiation of your being, not as like a specific culminating event, which is how a lot of people in our narrative fallacies will tend to view our lives. So that is a key difference, and that's why I found that people on the other side, ordinary people who I knew in real life, are able to sort of set up a chain of events or somehow predict something will happen or somehow do things that suggest that they are aware of something that indicates that they have a higher dimension perspective on things that we lack.
Let's go to Joseph in San Diego now. Hi, Joseph.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. I just wondered in the short period of time, couple of minutes we have left, I'll tell you a quick story. When I was very young, about five, I would get up at night, and I would look at the light in the living room and say, why am I here? And then later on, I started studying religions, and through high school, surfing, I'd always get to, when it got the TM and knew about Chipmunk interviewing Mike Love from the Beach Boys and Charles Lloyd and doing TM and stuff. So, you know, then read Siddhartha and then got through and eventually became a Brahmin monk and served in 9 years of being a Brahmin monk from India. And to me, the Vedas offer the most, if you want to say scientific, hypothesis of reality. And even to the point of saying that life begins at conception when the sperm enters the egg, that's when the soul enters. So that's more scientific. And if the pro-life would really you know, preach in that way instead of some metaphoric thing that's not very in depth, like, you know, the Bible's written for very simple people, and even Jesus said, there are many things I could tell you, but you wouldn't understand them, like reincarnation. So maybe Jesus was an avatar, and I wonder what he thought about the Vedic literatures.
The Vedic literature, of course, is very poignant, and there's lots of great information in there when you digest it and do it all. Jonathan, give out your website, if you would, for us.
It is zaporacle.com, Z-A-P, Oracle, O-R-A-C-L-E.
And you can watch Jonathan's films and all his other incredible works there. And his book is called Crossing the Event Horizon. Up next, we're going to the International Space Station on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next Thursday, Thanksgiving night, we'll have a live program for you. Richard Sheridan for me tomorrow. And we've got all kinds of great shows for you for the rest of the week. The International Space Station, of course, a habitable artificial satellite in low Earth orbit. It was launched in 1998, and they're going to operate it until 2028. Some time ago, I had a chance to talk to some amazing astronauts on the ISS.
Alpha, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Houston, this is Alpha. We are ready for the event.
Premier Radio Network, this is Houston. Please call Alpha for a voice check.
Alpha, this is George Norrie, host of Coast to Coast AM on the Premier Radio Network. How do you hear me?
George, we hear you loud and clear. This is Michael Foe, commander on the International Space Station, and Alexander Kaleri, the flight engineer.
Well, Michael and Alexander, it's good to talk with you here down on planet Earth. Let me ask you, first of all, you're up there 250 miles above the planet. Are you able to pinpoint anything on the planet? Can you see, for example, the pyramids whenever you circle the globe?
The pyramids are only just visible if you know where to look and you have a pair of binoculars. Another feature I have tried to look for is the Great Wall in China. That also is extremely difficult to pick out because it's of the same color as the background. Much easier features are things like cities or, of course, dams and reservoirs.
I'm really interested in your feelings, you, Michael, and you also, Alexander, when you have that ability to look out into the universe, look down at the planet. And, of course, to some of us here on planet Earth, we don't have that awe feeling yet because we don't have the ability to be up there in space. But what is it like, just as a human being, to be up there?
It is a unique sensation. Speaking for myself, one feels very fortunate, lucky. It's like being on top of a mountaintop or a hillside where you have a great view. It's a new perspective, and it makes one, if you're a thoughtful person, reflect on where you've come from, on the people that have helped you get here, especially, and on where humanity is going.
Alexander, let me ask you, if I can, tell me now, how long have you been up there in the International Space Station?
I cannot remember exactly. It seems to me for about 4 months, maybe 120, 125 or 30 days. I'm not sure.
For you, Alexander, and also for you, Michael, requirements for your day-to-day operations up there in the ISS. Generally, what does your day consist of? Let's start with you first, Michael.
On a regular basis, we get up at, we're meant to be getting up at 6 and be at work by 8. Breakfast, toilet, all those things are things we have to accomplish here the same as we would on Earth. Once we get into the workday, the days vary enormously from one day to the next. One day we might be doing quite a lot of work on laptops and computers, monitoring instruments that are already running that we have set up or were set up by people before us. And that's a fairly passive, keyboard-intensive task. Other days we could be fixing large pieces of equipment with wrenches and have the whole place torn up and have things floating around us and be doing an enormous amount of machine shop-type work. And on another day we might be getting spacesuits ready to take experiments outside and establish them on the outside of the space station. So our days are very varied, and it's sometimes hard to predict what the next week will be like.
Alexander, how do you keep your mind occupied within these projects? Many people on this planet, of course, get bored very quickly just by doing things here. What's it like in the International Space Station on a day-to-day basis, really, to keep yourself occupied, to keep your mind occupied?
Если я правильно понял вопрос, то у нас тоже тут иногда...
We also sometimes have very monotonous work tasks, but usually it's very varied. Sometimes it gets a little bit boring and routine gets us down, but sometimes it's very interesting, and usually the alteration of such work keeps us from getting really bored. I believe that we're at the top of a huge pyramid, at the bottom of which a lot of people are relying on us or expecting from us fruitful work, and this also helps us pull ourselves together. And sometimes there are very interesting grains of experiments and works that compensate for everything has been accumulated before, probably some negative emotions or something like that. So we keep ourselves fit by different means.
Alexander, a few weeks ago during the spacewalk, your space outfit began to fill up with water. Your helmet began to get wet. What was that like? I mean, did you know at that time what was going on?
I was able to understand that something was going on that was not supposed to. I felt quite well. At the moment, it was not yet clear what was going on and how it was going to be occurring at the time. At that particular moment, the situation was quite stable, but since we didn't know the reason of that anomaly, and we did not know if a drastic deterioration of the spacesuit was going to happen, that was the reason why the management of our flight decided to cut it short, to bring us back to the station since we achieved our major goals and stop our work at that point and look after we took off the spacesuits, what the reason was. After we looked at the cause, it became clear that at that time during the EVA, the situation would not have been deteriorating too greatly. We would have been able to continue working, but it was already thinking back into the situation. It didn't do any damage to either the program or to my health or to the tasks of the EVA.
Mike, these have been some very tense times and at the same time enlightening times, I think, to be aboard the International Space Station. In the past few months, of course, you had a small object sound that hit the space station. You then had an air leak that you and Alexander had to fix. Are there tense times aboard the ISS where sometimes you're concerned about your safety and the safety of Alexander?
Not in an acute sense. I would say we certainly haven't experienced any events of an acute nature. There are nagging worries where you know that if you let your guard down or you become sloppy in your work, everyday work, in paying attention to maintaining the safe standards of the space station, then you would endanger either your lives or the people who come after you. And so we have to be on our guard, carry out our jobs properly and completely, reporting all the discrepancies. Because of the number of backups or different ways we can overcome our problems that might arise, for example, leaks or other things of that nature, always I know that if we have this kind of steady methodology and we approach these things in a progressive way, we can always work them out and work around them with the ground. And that has been the case over this expedition. So that's what I rest on. I basically know that if I pay attention to detail and I follow these things carefully, we will remain safe. And that's been the case today.
Mike, when the space station is finally completed, it's going to be bigger than a football field. What percent is completed at this point?
That is a very hard question to answer, because I personally cannot imagine the full football field even being up here. We have windows only in certain directions, and actually looking up away from the Earth, or away from to the top of the station, as we would call it, it's rather hard to view it. So to imagine how big all those arrays will look is actually a little difficult for us. Nonetheless, just from what I know about the space station, I think in terms of hardware, we're of the order of 60% complete. But that's a very rough guess. Also, the space station is an international project and open-ended to some extent. There are a number of Russian modules that I know have been designed and people hope to launch. I know the U.S. Has got a new project, the Exploration Initiative, beyond the space station. But Japan and Europe may also have ideas that they would want to attach to the station beyond the current one. So it may be a little bit of a growing village is the way I would describe the space station. So it's hard to say how far it is complete.
There, of course, is, Mike, a possibility that the United States will get out of the International Space Station project in the future. If current plans are approved, that's a high likelihood. Do you find that to be disappointing? And tell me, what do you think the true scope and the use of this space station in the future will be for mankind?
Well, I'd like to build a little bit on my analogy to a small village. I do believe the International Space Station and the project will grow steadily as the years go by, and there will be maybe more or maybe different partners who become the main partners in the International Space Station project. That is not to say that the United States will not drop by and will not visit and will not make use of its already significant investment in the space station. And I think in many ways there will be times when it will be extremely helpful to test equipment that we want to take out of Earth orbit, for example, to the Moon or Mars, and test it at the International Space Station. There may be servicing that we will do better at the International Space Station than trying to do it somewhere else in low Earth orbit. So I don't think we're going to leave the International Space Station for good. It's, as I say, it's a growing town or village, and we will drop by even if we don't become... even if we don't remain the main inhabitants.
In its current configuration, Mike, what is the lifespan of the International Space Station? I mean, how long do you think it can function with current technology? And, of course, where do we look at it in the future? I mean, would we always update it, or would we have to build a brand new one, let's say, in 20 or 30 years?
One, for getting the most out of what you've already put a lot of sweat and work into. And so I would... building onto this thing and keep adding onto it. And if there are modules that are leaked or modules that are just too dirty and horrible to go into, then we'd seal them off and maybe at some point actually jettison them. But I think the base will remain, and I think we'll be building onto it, adding onto it, moving things around. So I think the life of the station is much longer than the planned life that I think was either 15 years extended to 30.
Of course, Mike, with the tragedy of the Space Shuttle Columbia and the fact that we are not resuming yet shuttle flights has really, I think, put some pressure now on the Russians to continue to supply the space station and to continue, of course, with its launches. Once the resumption does occur, how much pressure do you think that will take off everybody involved with the ISS?
It'll be significant, but not immediate. Though, because there are a number of outstanding construction activities to be resumed on the International Space Station using the Space Shuttle to launch those heavy, large pieces of equipment that are now waiting at Cape Kennedy, the Kennedy Space Center. Once those are assembled in here, then I think the Space Shuttle will start to offload significantly the other partners in its ability to carry cargo. But as we understand it, once the space station is assembled, that's when the space shuttle will stop flying. So I'm not sure the relief is really going to be that much felt by our partners.
Alexander, I have always believed that space bridges the gap, I think, between humanity. Of course, there are no politics involved when it comes to an astronaut and a cosmonaut. In your particular case, what's it like working with your counterpart?
I believe that the International Space Station is a very good place for crews. When we are disregarding our political background or our national affiliations, work together when there are no political forces involved in complicating our work, we feel great. This is a very important project and a very important thing that helps us find common ground between the nations for implementation of future projects that have been declared now, Mars project and Moon project. It's impossible to go on with the international cooperation unless we manage to work with each other in simpler circumstances. So I believe the International Space Station is a very interesting project and very important and useful work to benefit future projects.
Michael, on Monday, astronomers revealed that they had indeed found what could very well be the 10th planet in the solar system. They call it a planetoid. The marvels, of course, in this universe just continue and continue. Are you at the belief that at least in terms of life out there, maybe like human beings, that it could be out there somewhere?
Well, yes, that is my belief, and I just have to always, if ever I have any doubt, look out the window, just as you can on Earth on a clear, starry night. And when you look at the countless stars that are visible, and you think of the likelihoods of planets, which we know are already there from observations by telescopes such as the Hubble, it jumps out at you that it would be the most foolish bet you could ever make that there was no life other than on Earth.
Mike, a number of astronauts in the past had always reported seeing some very strange things, unusual lights, things they really couldn't determine exactly what they might be. Have you or Alexander ever come across anything that you spotted out there that you figured, I have no idea what this is?
yes, often initially I have seen things that have caught my attention, surprised me. Unfortunately, and I say this with regret, because I'm a child at heart and a romantic, I end up finding an explanation for what I've just seen in terms of fitting into my already very broad knowledge of physics and astronomy. For example, the other day I was looking out the window as we crossed Terminator, that's the border between the light side and the dark side of the Earth. It was very beautiful. It's a whole shade of violet, blue colors. And below us, moving past, across the field of view, was this bright, flashing object. And it initially looked just like an airplane going into an airport with its lights flashing. And I was thinking, oh, it's an airplane. Oh, no, it can't be an airplane because it's about, you know, somewhere near us. And I watched it go by very fast, and I thought about it. Now I thought about calling Sasha, but then I thought, no, I know what it is. We're crossing the Terminator. It's probably a piece of debris that's come off. Actually, it couldn't have been debris because it was in the wrong orbit, but it was a lower satellite, I'm pretty sure, that was below us and spinning and reflecting at us as it went by. There are many little events like this, lights that we see in particular outside that initially don't seem really obvious, but after you think about them, you can come up with an explanation.
Well, indeed, Michael, the marvels of the universe. Look, we've got about a minute left, and with 5 to 10 million listeners who think about you and Alexander all the time, we haven't forgotten you. Any final statements to the world?
I just want to say that people should keep looking up at the stars, thinking about where we are on the planet Earth and where we are in the solar system and in the galaxy. We need to fix our problems on Earth, but that should never stop us dreaming and looking beyond the horizon and looking up towards the stars. And I believe the work that the United States in particular has put into this project is extremely worthwhile, not only for the United States, but for the rest of the world. It's a great project to take part in, one we should be proud of. So thank you very much for putting us here.
And thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us here on Coast to Coast. You, Mike Fole, and you, Alexander Kaleri. Thank you.
You're always welcome.
Thank you, George Norrie with Coast to Coast AM. Alpha, we are now resuming operational space-to-ground communication.
Well, that fascinates me. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.